Welcome to Heart with Keisha B., the podcast that focuses on the journey of grief, healing, and overcoming unforeseen circumstances. Whether you're dealing with loss or life challenges, this is a podcast that you don't want to miss. I am your host, Keisha B. So take a deep breath, open your mind and your soul, and sit back as we embark on this journey together. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another week of Heart to Heart with Keisha B. As you know, on Sundays, this is when I do my my bonus episode, but just like last week, right? So if you've been following me, and I hope that you have, you know that I am not going to get this podcast started, this episode started, until we have at least 15 people here on this stage. So right now, I only have myself and I have Jimmy. So if you're watching right now, if you've logged on, you know what I'm going to tell you. I'm going to challenge you right now. This is my call of action. My call of action is for you to call somebody, text somebody, scream to the next room, tag somebody, whatever you got to do, right? But we will not start this podcast until we have 15 people. So I'm counting on you just like I did last week. So Jimmy, we're just going to sit here for a little bit, right? This is what we're doing here on Heart to Heart with Keisha B.
Nothing wrong with it.
We'll wait to see how many people we get in the room today. I see one. I see the numbers are going to slowly creep up. So whoever that one guest is, go ahead and call somebody, text somebody, tag somebody, scream, holler, whatever you got to do. But tell them this is another episode of Heart to Heart with Keisha B that they don't want to miss. And again, if you've been watching any of my episodes and or listening, you will know that I always bring somebody on this here podcast that's going to be nothing more than an inspiration to everyone that is listening and to those who have yet to listen.
Absolutely. So
Jimmy, while we're just waiting, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. I feel good.
That's good.
How are you feeling?
I'm well. I want to thank you, as I always do with all my guests, and say thank you for taking time out to be very vulnerable, right? Be very vulnerable and share you with others. It takes a lot of courage to do that.
Absolutely. And I appreciate that. I truly believe vulnerability is not weakness. It is a superpower. So
yeah, for sure. For sure.
Absolutely.
So we're still waiting on some people in the room. So we want to get this podcast started. I will even be a little bit nice today. I'm going to say if we can get at least 10 people. I normally don't lessen the challenge, but I want to do this call of action. I want to say if we can get 10 people here in the room, we'll go ahead and get this podcast started. Jimmy, anybody you want to sort of call out to say, hey, if you listen and jump on right now?
I mean, if you follow me, jump on. If you're from the west side of Charleston and you know what it's like to grow up on the west side of Charleston, jump on. And if you're in recovery, jump on. If you love the Lord, jump on.
Yeah. And I heard some call to actions. I've heard some challenges. We went from 15 to 10 to calling people out that's from the west side that love the Lord, that have faced some trials and tribulations or just need some sense of hope, right? Jump here on this podcast. Right now, we got some people coming in, but we need some more.
Absolutely. I think we're going to experience a little bit of hope during this podcast. Definitely some poetry, which is kind of my forte. It's my probably number one tool that I love that God has gifted me with. And yeah, I think it'll be dope.
Yeah. Yeah. But Jimmy, you know what? I'm not going to, I know that once you start talking, folks going to come on in, because again, let me do this call of action again. I hear if you're from the west side of Charleston, right? If you need a little bit of hope in your life, jump on. If you need a little bit of inspiration, jump on. If you need a little bit of, religion today, jump on. If you want to hear a little bit of good poetry, you know, snap your fingers, the poetry, jump on up in this podcast today, because I see the numbers are starting to go up. So at this time, I'm going to go ahead and get started. As you all know, Heart to Heart with Keisha B is a podcast that we have bonus episodes every Sunday, and then we drop our regular episodes on Wednesdays. But this here podcast is for those who are in the midst of grieving, healing, or overcoming unforeseen circumstances. And as you all know, that means that this is a wide range of guests in which we can have here on this episode. If you've been watching any of my podcasts, you know that I've had from the matter of someone losing a person to a divorce. Last week, I had someone who talked about what they went through from childhood through domestic violence up into being an entrepreneur today. And today, our guest Jimmy is going to bring a whole nother aspect to what it looked like to face some unforeseen circumstances, but be able to heal through that. And he's going to share with you why and how he's healed and why he is still continuously healing through things that he may have dealt with through his childhood as well as his adulthood. So at this time, for those who know and those who don't, I want to go ahead and introduce Jimmy, the poet. How you doing, Jimmy?
I'm doing well.
Thank you.
I very much appreciate the opportunity to speak with you, the people that follow you, the people who follow me as well, you know?
Yeah. So, Jimmy, I want to share with our guests, because we do have the numbers starting to go up now, that this is a podcast. The purpose of my bonus podcast, bonus episodes, is to allow this to be a live episode. And what does that mean? What that means is that not only do our guest, Jimmy, be able to share his story, but there's also an opportunity for anyone that is watching to also join as well, whether it's through questions through the chat or whether they say, hey, I would love to come on live with you all. So that is an opportunity as well. So again, if you're watching this here podcast, know that it's not just about a matter of listening, but it's also about a matter of engaging as well. So please know that on Heart to Heart with Keisha B, this podcast is for everyone, for those that are the guests, as well as those who are listening. So at this time, Jimmy, I'm going to turn it over to you. And what I always ask my guests first and foremost, is why are you here on Heart to Heart with Keisha B? And how does your story resonate with the topic of what we do here on Heart to Heart with Keisha B?
All right. Once again, I'm honored. I'm very honored. I did reach out to you. I saw the young king, Taran Rush, was on. And that's a kid that who's no longer a kid. He's a grown man and he's a strong pillar in this community. I love that dude. When he was a kid, I was a teacher at Emmanuel Baptist Church, which was really the Bob Burnett Center that we all grew up under. And so when I saw that, I watched part of the podcast. I plan on finishing it. And I reached out to you immediately. And I remembered you from State when I used to do poetry at State. Mm-hmm. And I said, hey, I would love to be a part of it. And I feel that, have I lost people? For sure. The grief that I really kind of want to hammer in on today was the grief that I experienced when I realized that I had lost myself and how that impacted my 20s. And we'll get there.
So, Jimmy, you know, before we go on into this podcast, I do want to thank you for reaching out, right? Because what I heard you say when you reached out, before I actually heard you say this, is there's something that I have on the inside of me, right, that I've been dealing with or that I've dealt with, but I know that my story could be an inspiration to someone else. And again, I must say that's what Heart to Heart with Keisha B is about. It's about being able to be vulnerable, right, be very transparent, but also know that when we need help, our testimony can also help somebody else's. And so at this time, I'm going to open up for you to give your testimony to our audience and tell us about who is Jimmy the Poet.
Absolutely. So I'm born and raised on the west side of Charleston. I'm an Edith Stu kid. I am a Tiscawall kid. I'm a west side baby. I went to Tiscawall, Stonewall, Cap, class of 06. Very, very, very proud graduate of Cap Nasty. So yeah, you know, I grew up on the west side, my mom and dad. And let me preface all of my story by saying my mother is phenomenal. My mother did the best with what she had, and she did so great within a lot of that. I wouldn't know how to tip at restaurants, be kind to women, do a lot of the things that I know how to do without the guidance of my mother. So with that said, I grew up, my mom and dad sold dope, did dope, a lot of domestic violence. Me, my mom, and my brother used to have to sleep on the streets. Mm-hmm. Plenty of night, me, my mom, and my brother would sleep at the gazebo at Tiscawall. And I couldn't really get sleep because not only do I felt as the big brother that I need to protect them, I cannot allow my friends to see us sleeping outside. You feel what I'm saying?
Yes.
That was rough. That mm-hmm. was very rough. And to do what I do with poetry, I have a piece that kind of exemplifies what I went through at that time. It's also untitled. Tiscawall is the elementary school that I went to. So if people hear it in the poem, they might not understand the reference, but it goes like this. Let me tell you a story. without having to flex imagination, stretching the fabrication about death and impurity and its complete saturation, about ruined birthdays, holidays, and vacations. But what you know about pitting cups to the wall, just to listen for a minute. And when I did it, thank God that beach ball busted her fall. So, you know, we ran in just to see him stomping her. But you think it mattered much to 7 to 8? We were screaming to get off of her. It didn't, because if we get in it, then we get it. And the results, they was monstrous. The outcome was out we go. Irrelevant of weather's below, sleeping underneath cars, porches, and gazebos. You're over there at Cisco Wall. If my friends would have caught me, that alone could have socially risked it all. So after mourning the next morning, you know, I'm chilling with my people, but inside it's hard to smile today when I know my mama's getting beat half to death less than a mile away. And there's nothing I can do to change it. The stress, it was amazing. Maybe someone should have asked us, but I was scared to death that the questions would never make it until one of us made it to the casket. And even though we was wishing for these whippings to stop, that wasn't the worst of it. You see, his mind game shaped my mind frame into thinking no one could ever love me. Insecurity's been blurring me inside, outside. Thought every part of me was ugly. So therefore, the word violent is not a verb. It's not just the action of someone hitting you. In all actuality, the term violence occasionally is referred to as physical. But in domestic violence, it usually takes someone dying for them to realize that the excuses were pitiful. They didn't recognize the signs, must have been used to the abuse. I guess they worked construction because destruction was a ritual. We've become so accepted to drama and adapted to pain. The bombs of deception and depression keep attacking every map to the brain. So with all said, the next time that I'm walking in my section, if I see a man put his hands on a woman, if no one else mans up, I'm man enough to address him. So, you know, from a very, very early age. Wow. Thank you. Thank you. At a very, very early age, the desire to be enough. Mm-hmm. And I'm a firm believer, you know, I'm very much Christian, so I have a Christian worldview. So I'm a firm believer that other than sin, the number one ailment facing humanity is the fear of not being enough, the fear of rejection. And when you do not believe that you are enough, you're going to find a group of people to convince you that you are. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, what then becomes the standard? Is it selling dope? Is it promiscuity? Or is it, hey, you know, getting a 3.0, getting a college degree and things to that effect? Mm-hmm. So at a very early age, I was thirsty. Thirsty for validation. Thirsty for affirmation. Mm-hmm. Quickly realized that I had a couple jokes in my pocket. So I was the class clown in every situation in school. I was getting suspended 7-8 times a year sometimes. So, you know, this all transfers going into middle school, going into Stonewall. And I'm class clown, suspended constantly. I remember, I think it was my 8th grade year, I wanted to wrestle because I was a big wrestling fan. Everybody growing up knew I was a Stone Cold Steve Austin fan. You couldn't tell me nothing. But the crazy part is, as I look throughout my life, a lot of the people in pop culture that I looked up to stood up against injustice in the system, even if it was in their own way. Because I grew up in a house where I was not allowed to question the depravity that was going on. I wasn't allowed to question, why you beating my mother, yo? I was not allowed to question, why are we sleeping outside? And so in Stonewall, once again, just class clown, I need attention. Well, prior to going to Stonewall, I got into a fight at the funeral home right beside Emmanuel Baptist Church my 6th grade year. Mm-hmm. And two women who I owe my entire life to, Kim Creel and Nita Garland, came out and stopped that fight. And my brother had us already going to Emmanuel, which is what we call the Bobberdett Center. We loosely call it Emmanuel. And they came out, they stopped the fight, they get to talking to us, and I'm tripping, and they bring me into Emmanuel, and they start talking to me. They were like, how would you like to come here? And I'm like, okay, I'll come. And then I start learning about Jesus. Mm-hmm. And then I start learning about just different things. And none of it really clicked at the time. I was 12 years old. But I was terrible there, too. Like, you can ask the twins, you can ask Canada, anybody that grew up with me at Emmanuel and Tiscawall. I was tripping. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so they never gave up on me. And so by the time I was probably 14 or 15, I think they realized, hey, this kid's got leadership abilities. instead of just constantly trying to kick him out the door, why don't we put a whistle in his hand and let him start working with some of the younger kids? Mm-hmm. And I want to say maybe Taran and them were that age at the time. I don't really remember, but it did some. So it just, I wouldn't even know the Lord if it wasn't for the Bobberdet Center. I would not know the Lord if it wasn't for Kim Krill and Nita Garland. God would have raised up a rock to do it, but those are the rocks he chose, and I'm forever grateful to them. I would love to buy them a house one day and retire them. That would be fire. So long story short, you know, I'm in Stonewall and nothing's really changing. My eighth grade year, I wanted to wrestle, so I got good enough grades to do that. I became a county wrestling champion with 24-2. And this was the first time in my life that I was able to say I succeeded in something. They gave me some confidence. So, you know, now I'm going into Capitol High. Nothing's changing at home. All throughout middle, elementary, middle, and high school, many a night we slept in the streets. Many a night I had to learn how to pick my battles. And I used to always hear, I'm not your real dad anyway. Gary Mullins is. Mm-hmm. And so from a very young age, I have father issues. From a very young age. Mm-hmm. So 10th grade, I'm at Emmanuel Baptist Church, waiting for the school bus to go to Capitol. And me and this kid, we started arguing. And we was about to fight. He didn't really want to fight. And so he pulled out a gun. And I'm not tough. Look, I wear my seatbelt. You can't be a thug and wear a seatbelt. It just don't work like that. I be wearing my seatbelt. I ain't no thug. But I don't know why I did it. But when he pulled that gun out, I took my book bag off and was like, I know you did not just pull a gun. And I was about to still swing on him and he shot me. Mm-hmm. And I was not like some kid that was in the streets like that. I was just bad at school. I had a lot of attention seeking habits. I mm-hmm. was desperate for, I was really desperate for family, to be honest with right. you. Even though I did, don't get me wrong, my dad, he did all that he did, but he raised a son that was not his. Mm-hmm. There were also a lot of good times. Everything mm-hmm. wasn't completely terrible.
Right.
You know, growing up, my mom and dad, you know, they sold dope. So we had everything we wanted financially. And my friends never really understood just because we had the Xbox, the PlayStation, the GameCube, everything when it came out, we had. My brother wanted the Jordans, he'd get the Jordans. Me, I would go to Champs and get two for 89. You feel me? And so all of that was taken care of. But the spiritual, mental and emotional anguish was not complemented by the finances by any stretch mm-hmm. of the imagination. Mm-hmm. So when I get shot, I had already knew the Lord prior. I had a little bit of an understanding, but of mm-hmm. course, a near-death experience is a catalyst, not only for change, but of a deeper spiritual awakening, if you will.
Right.
And so I get shot and I didn't expect that. Nobody in my life expected me to get shot. And so it really drew me so deep into a relationship with the Lord. I remember when I was in my bedroom one day and I was upset. I couldn't play basketball, which was just something I did at Emmanuel, not like for no team because I wasn't nice like that. I couldn't go to school. I couldn't do anything. And I'm sitting there and I'm angry and I'm crying and I'm frustrated and I'm mad at the person that shot me. And then I opened up the Bible and it was Romans chapter 12, verses 14 through 21, which talked about don't repay evil for evil, but evil for good. Vengeance mm-hmm. is the Lord's. If your enemy is thirsty, give him something to drink. When I tell you that in Miss Keisha, in an instant, my heart went from anger and sadness to empathy and sympathy. I started wow. praying for this kid. I started crying for this kid. Mm-hmm. I'm good at poetry and I know how to throw a couple words together with talking, and that's all fine. But I think my biggest gift is empathy. Mm-hmm. I think I've always had it. But I think that night, it was like some big spiritual deposit. It was like Bitcoin empathy all of my soul. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so I went to school the next day and I wrote letters to a couple kids that I had talked bad about. I went and apologized to teachers. I started becoming this different person mm-hmm. that my friends didn't recognize. I started falling deeply, deeply in love with the Lord. Now, I've been freestyling since I was 11 years old. From the moment I ever touched marijuana, I started rapping. Mm-hmm. And so in middle school, I started writing poetry. I had my heart broke. My 10th grade year, I got on stage in front of a whole group of people and did a whole poem about me turning my life over to Christ. And from that moment forward, from 16, 17, 18, I had met a man named Andy Palmer, who I'm still very close to this day. And I love with That man allowed me to get on platforms. Woody Woods allowed me to get on platforms. Back in the TJ, the DJ days, I was on Woody Woods, you know, 98.7 at 16 years old, spitting bars. And I started to see this purpose and this potential that was matching this passion, because I've always wanted to help people. I just didn't know what direction it was going to go into. And so I became the youth team leader for an organization called Chainbreakers. A lot of people probably remember. And Andy and me were together every day for years. And we would go talk to Sherman High School. I'll go speak in front of 1,500 people. Now, mind you, I might go speak in front of 1,500 kids in an auditorium, get a standing ovation. God is using me to bring people to tears, all these things. Still go home, have to sleep on the streets because of my dad. Mm-hmm. And so where my story leads later in life, one of the conclusions I had to come to as to why that happened is unprocessed trauma. So, you know, I graduate high school and I get a full ride to college. Chainbreakers was like, yo, we go where do you want to go? And all I really wanted to do was go to World Harvest Bible College in Columbus, Ohio. Mm-hmm. I fell in love with now the mother of my children, and I didn't really want to leave. And so I decided to go locally. And at this time, you know, my mom, she was doing some other things that I'm not going to mention. And it was involving, you know, back in the dope dealing and what have you that we talked about earlier. At this time at 18, I also found out that my dad wasn't my real dad. And if you've ever seen The Matrix, it felt like I had exited it. Because it was like, you mean to tell me my entire life I've gone through this? You mean to tell me I sit and watch this? You mean to tell me I had to endure all of this and I didn't really even have to? This was how I felt at that time. I felt hornswoggled, bamboozled, every other word you can think of. But I was told, he would tell me my whole life, I'm not your real dad anyway. Mm-hmm. And so when this happened, I didn't really know what to do. And so I went through a deep depression. I started smoking black and mouths again. I started drinking, started smoking weed. Now I'm popping out babies left and right, not taking care of them. Nobody knows what's going on. You're Jimmy the Poet. Mm-hmm. You just spent 3 years talking to kids about doing the right thing, about not doing drugs, things to these effect. You feel what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And so, for a lack of better terms, I became lost in the sauce.
Right.
2011, I had my wisdom teeth taken out. And by this time, I've got my daughter was born in 2010. So by this time, we got three kids back to back. 2011, they wrote me a script of Percocet. And it was on from there. And it went from Percocets to Roxy's. And then one day I went to somebody, I was dope sick, which is what happens when you don't have opiates that you become addicted to. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to get a 30, which is a Roxy 30. It's a blue pill. And they didn't have any, but they was like, hey, I have this. And it was heroin. And I had never saw it before. Mm-hmm. It was just this, you know, it was China white heroin, just this powdery substance. And I'm very, very close to this person. I immediately left. I cried. I'm like, man, I didn't think they was on here. But I was so dope sick. I mean, obviously I had a choice, but in my mind at the time, I did not have a choice. Anybody listening right now that's ever been dope sick, you know what it is. You know what it's like. And I'm a firm believer that there's this ideology called strategies of warfare. So the enemy, which I consider to be, of course, Satan. I also consider to be the lazy version of myself, my flesh, the disease of addiction in of itself. Knew that at 16, when I'm speaking to auditoriums full of children about doing the right thing, you can't offer me meth. You can't offer me heroin. Mm-hmm. It takes a slow wearing down. And so what did I do? I snorted the heroin. Now I'm on heroin. The shame, the guilt, the me hiding it. My best friends didn't know. My wife didn't know. Mm-hmm. My kids were too young to comprehend any of it. And I tried and tried to hide it. And this was the beginning of me grieving the loss of me. Because now I'm like, you know, I'm in my young 20s. I know my potential. I know my gifting. I know the platforms God had placed me on. But now I'm here stuck on heroin, living in my mom's house, not taking care of my babies, becoming the very thing I never wanted to be. For the longest time, my standard of a good father was anything that wasn't my stepfather. Right. Who I don't even want to dishonor, God rest his soul. I don't ever use the word stepfather. I only really do that in reference because that man raised me and I love that man. Mm-hmm. And he gave me my little brother who I adore. I love my little brother. Most people that know me know my little brother as well. And so I'm living in this guilt and this shame and I just can't get out of it. It's deep. It's dark. It's depressing. So 2013, I called my dad, who was really like a spiritual father, Bishop Stockton. And he had moved to California to take on a church. And I said, look, I'm on heroin. I know it broke his heart. You know, he's called me son for so long. He's been the most consistent version of a father I've ever had in my life. If you're here, Dad, I love you. And he's like, look, you know, you're not really doing much for the kids anyway. Why don't we get you out here for a year? Get your mind right. You got a gift. Let's see what can happen. And so 2014, I moved to Los Angeles. I went to a rehab out there in the middle of Skid Row, which is the largest homeless population in America. And I tried to do the best I could. Now, at this time, I thought heroin was my problem. I didn't know that heroin was a way that I was trying to heal from what I deemed to be my problems. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so I was smoking weed during that program. I was snorting pills during that program. But all along, unbeknownst to me, hey, I'm not doing heroin. I'm all good. So at the 6-month mark of me being away from my 4 children, because she gave birth while I was out there to my youngest, they drug tested me and I had to start all the way over. And they said, look, you can either bounce or you can start this year program all the way over. I'm like, man, what? My wife didn't know I relapsed. Mm-hmm. Nobody at home knew. You know, I'm feeding them these stories that everything is fine. And this is something I tell now to people that are in jail or in rehab. Stop feeding your baby mother, your children, all of these. This is what I plan to do. Nobody cares anymore. After the 7th, 8th time you've been in rehab, you've been in prison, less talk, more action. And I've had to learn that the hardest of ways. So they start me over. After about a month, I'm like, nah, scratch this. I got to get back home to my kids. Mm-hmm. Nothing's changed on the inside of me. The only thing really changed was I was absent from heroin for 6 months. All right. So I get back home here in 2014, later in the year. Within a day or two, I relapse. Well, I never really was sober. And now, you know, I'm in front of my wife and my 4 kids. And of course, they're probably like, daddy's home, hubby's home. Things are going to be good now. You know, you send your family members off to rehab and it's like, oh, they get magically healed there. And that's really not how it works. Right. Because you have to put the work in. Healing is available to us, but we have to participate in our own healing. It has to be that way. Mm-hmm. And so I get back here and I get back on heroin. I get a fire job installing cable. I'm like a week away from being able to get my own truck and run my own routes. Mm-hmm. But your boy was robbing every house that I was installing cable at. I was taking guns, money, pills. I got caught doing that and got hit with my first felony ever for a residential burglary. Mm-hmm. They couldn't prove that I had prior intent, because when you break a law in this country, before they can actually convict you, before they can even indict you on the law, they have to prove certain elements of the law. So one law may have like 5 elements of that crime, and they have to meet a certain threshold of like 2, 3, or 4 before they can even charge you with it. And so they couldn't meet that threshold. It got dropped to a misdemeanor. And I was like, look, and I told my wife at the time, I said, I got to get back to California. I can't be here. And I didn't know what it was for. I didn't know, but I felt like God was calling me out there. And it was tough. It was hard. But through the end of this talk and through the end of not where my journey ends, because I'm still alive, you'll see that why I'm so grateful that I went back. So I go back out to California and I'm living in a shelter. I'm working and I was doing okay for like 3 months. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, like, you know, they want their father. Wife wants her husband. So they decided to come out. And we went into a program called the Dream Center in Echo Park. And this is like 2015. summer of 2015. And we were supposed to be there for 2 years. We didn't have to work. I mean, we didn't have to pay no money. All we had to do was work and go to school. I don't know if I couldn't handle the pressure. I don't know what it was, but after about a month of being there, I relapsed. Now I'm on meth. Mm-hmm. And they put me in their discipleship program. I got kicked out of there. Mm-hmm. Then they kicked me out of everything. And I remember when I looked at that building and I thought, I'm never going to be good for them and I'm never going to be good to them. The best thing I could do is exit their life. Mm-hmm. Now, I know firmly if they weren't in such a safe environment, I never would have just ran the streets without them. Mm-hmm. I would have got us back home to West Virginia, but they were in a safe Christian environment. She started killing it, even though it was hard for her. She started going to school. All of those things happened. You know, it was such a great time for them, but it was still like, yo, where's my husband at, man? Where's my father at, you know? And so now I'm running the streets of LA. I'm in Skid Row, Hollywood, MacArthur Park, Compton, South Central. I'm getting high on crystal meth. I'm doing God knows what. I'm living in and out of tents. And I used to tell people, you know, I grew up in West Virginia, but the most racism I've ever experienced is the California prison system. I also grew up in West Virginia, and I've spent more time in a tent in LA than I ever have in the state of West Virginia. And so 2017, she decided to come back with the kids, which she had every right to do because it's, you know, that's a scary place to be by yourself.
Right.
She gets back here with the kids. They start to get stabilized. About a month after they go back, I catch my first felony out there. Now, by this time, I'm going back and forth to LA County Jail, petty theft, possession, whatever. Now I catch my first residential burglary, a felony and a strike. And I spent about 5 months fighting that case. And then they gave me a program. And in that program, it was freedom. I didn't even have to drug test. It was just in MacArthur Park. It was a old hotel. You just had to check in with a PO once a week and be in by 10. And within 2 days, I was smoking meth again. And now not only do I have a place to lay my head, now I have a place to bring all of my stolen stuff. Because I'm out there going throughout the city, stealing stuff, breaking into houses, breaking into cars, tripping, stealing cars, just tripping. And the whole time, I'm Jimmy the Poet. You know, this whole, not a facade, but this whole identity that I had created as a teenager of this wholesome Christian. And none of that was never fake. It's just when unprocessed trauma meets addiction, meets the inability to make sound decisions, you get catastrophic results. And I'm just grateful by the grace and the mercy of the Most High that I'm not dead right now.
Right.
And so we talk about keep your crown on. When I was on the streets of LA, when I was homeless, I would be in Skid Row. Even though I'd be high, I'd be breaking the law, tripping, doing things that I'm doing, I would tell people, keep your crown on, King. Keep your crown on, Queen. I was always an encourager of other people. I've always had, my number one love has always been other people. Like, I love people. I will do anything I can. I will go out of my way. I'm in love with God's people. And so you fall down a flight of stairs or you fall off your bike, I'm probably going to laugh at you. But if I see you're really sad and you're hurt, it touches the depths of my soul. Mm-hmm. And so I used to tell people, keep your crown on. Now, 2018, I catch another residential burglary and another strike. Now the judge ain't playing with me. My dad, Bishop Stockton, he can't even spoke for me. Judge still wasn't playing with me. Judge was like, nah, I don't want to hear it. Appreciate your dad coming to speak, but nah, bro, you've been doing too much. You're going to prison. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, supposed to be 4 years. California had passed Prop 57. Which basically, if you do your base term with good behavior, you can get out in half the time. And so, yeah, I go to prison. And I remember the bus ride from, my mouth always got me out of problems. My mouth always got me out of trouble. The day that the prison bus came and it went from LA County jail shackles to California State Prison shackles was the first time in my life when I actually realized, like, oh, no, you're really going to pay the consequences for these actions now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you had sent me some phenomenal questions. And one of the questions asked, when did I realize that I was ready to walk a different path in life? And in this stage in my life, I realized it on that prison bus, because I had decided either I'm a loser and there's no hope for me, or there is hope for me. And I decided the latter. And that was a decision. You feel what I'm saying?
I do. So, Jimmy, let me ask you a question. I want to take it back a little bit, because I know we have people that's coming in and out to sort of catch them up to speed to where we are today. Let's go back to that young little boy who was on the west side of Charleston, right? Right there at Tiscawall by the underpass. But this kid was homeless. This kid was going through a home of domestic violence. But what I heard you say is that there's a likelihood many of your peers did not know what was going on.
Absolutely. We were never homeless necessarily. There were just nights that to run from my father, we would sleep on the streets. We would sleep on the streets, you know, because it was, we call it hood rich growing up, you know, because we were basically hood rich to an extent. I never had to worry about food. I never had to worry about a bill getting cut off. We were on vacation twice a year. I spent my 16th birthday in Vegas. So financially, everything was great. We had $2,000-$3,000 Christmases. And my friends would only see that. And they were like, yo, you got it so good. Do I? Right. Because you know that the consequence of my mom and dad selling dope and getting this money while they're also doing the dope while they're getting this money is a little bit of instability. And my dad was crazy. And so none of my friends knew about the domestic violence. And why would they? Why would I want to expose ourselves? You feel what I'm saying? I've had CPS come to my school. And why would I was taught at a very young age, you don't talk to cops, and CPS are the same as cops.
So that actually takes me into the question I was going to ask in regards to not just your friends that may have or may have not known the school. Right. So whenever you would go to school and you would, as you said, act out, right, you would be funny. Was there ever a time throughout your education that maybe the educators, like your teachers, knew that something wasn't going on? And the reason I asked that question is because a lot of what you have described, we actually see that today in schools, right? We actually see children who are going through domestic violence, parents getting arrested, things of that sort. They go to school and their behaviors are exhibited in school. And many times teachers think they're bad kids, right? They're not bad kids. They're kids that are faced with trauma, but they cannot talk or don't want to talk out of fear of getting judged. So how did that look like for you at school? Did anybody ever know what Jimmy was going through inside of his home?
I'll be honest with you. I think neighbors had called CPS a couple times, so that's maybe how the school got wind of it when CPS would first come. I think I remember two times I've been questioned by CPS. And of course, I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. It was normalized. Mm-hmm. I think I remember the day that I realized that, oh, other people don't go through this. Other people don't watch their mom get beat up. Mm-hmm. Other people are not at school scared to death that they're going to come home and their mom's dead. Like, that's not a normal thing. You feel what I'm saying? And so I'll be honest with you. And this is, again, to tip my hat off to Kim Creel and Nita Garland. It really wasn't until I went to Emmanuel that somebody started asking deeper questions. Like, okay, why is this kid tripping so much? Like, what's going on? I wasn't the bad kid. Like, I was fighting all the time. I was just an attention seeker. And I had ADHD like crazy, so you couldn't keep my attention on nothing. And so, but it was just constant, like couldn't shut up, always needing attention, and would do pretty much and say whatever I could to get a rise out of people and to get a laugh. I still kind of struggle. My affinity for shock value might get me in trouble one day. But it was Kim Creel and Nita Garland that really started asking deeper questions.
Yeah. So let me ask you a question again, Jimmy, based upon what you're saying. This comes from Keisha, who is the host of this show. This comes from Keisha, who has faced trauma in her life. This comes from Keisha, who happened to see her father lying on the stairs, murdered when I was three. This comes from Keisha, who grew up in a home of parents who were addicted to drugs. This comes from Keisha, a woman who also lost her mother from murder when I was 8 years old. The behaviors I hear that you say that you were exhibiting, is it really that Jimmy was ADHD, or was it that Jimmy was a kid that was going through a lot and had to find a way to not let what he was going through interfere with other aspects of his life? So it's almost like you were trying to push that away, right? You wanted to leave that to the side. You wanted to leave that and have a place to where I just want to have fun. I just want to be a kid that don't have to deal with all the stressors, right? And Keisha, why do you say that? Keisha say that because Keisha was that kid who had an attitude all the time. I wasn't mad at the kids I was fighting, right? I wasn't mad or had an attitude with my teachers, even though sometimes they thought I was. I was Keisha who was faced with trauma. And I didn't know any other way to exhibit that trauma other than find another coping mechanism, even though that coping mechanism would have been seen and is seen as negative. And so I asked you that same question of when you start to look at your life, is it more so that Jimmy was being funny, getting in trouble in school because he was a bad kid, or was he a kid that was facing trauma or who had faced trauma?
I'm definitely funny. No, I'm playing. I'm definitely the latter. A lot of it was... I tell people I could last on a deserted island probably 30% more than the average person just off the ability to keep myself entertained. But back to your question, definitely the trauma. You know, I can answer that with a twofold answer very briefly. Mm-hmm. If you go look at the prison population, or if you go look at the rehab population, I guarantee you, and it's statistically backed up, that the large majority of the people that find themselves in those situations have what we call very high ACEs, which is adverse childhood experiences. Mm-hmm. So ACEs is adverse childhood experience score. It's a 10 question questionnaire that I would always give my clients to gauge, okay, how much trauma have you experienced? Do I blame everything on my trauma? Of course not. Our lives are a culmination of decisions other people make that we don't have control over until we get to an age of an accountability, and then we are responsible for our decisions. And I remember I took the Xbox from my 12-year-old one time, and he said, "That's not fair." I said, "Life's not fair." He said, "You know what? I'm sick and tired of hearing that, because if life's not fair for everybody, then that makes life fair." Oh, bro, here, take the Xbox back. I can't even argue with you. So ultimately, my life led the path it did because of decisions I made. However, yes, very much trauma played a part. And the second part of that twofold answer I will give you, I absolutely love teaching Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And so if we take a 12-year-old kid who has to constantly worry about food, constantly have to worry about, is the electric bill going to be on, constantly have to worry about, hey, are we moving from Orchard Manor to City Park this week? Which is not my story, but it's a lot of other people's story. Are we moving out of the trailer park? Mm-hmm. Or, hey, are we moving from South Hills because my dad left and we have to go down to live in the flats of Canal City, or maybe South Park housing projects now? You never know. So that's right. The first two levels, physiological needs, security needs. Let's go to level three, love and belonging. Well, dad's not there, or we hear that all the time. How about, oh, man, mom's not there. You know, love and belonging is out of whack. So when the first three levels are so unstable, how are they going to be primed to reach the fourth level, which is esteem, you know, accomplishments? And how is it even possible that we can reach the fifth level, which is self-actualization? It's not even feasible. And so what we do a lot of the times, do I think ADHD is a real thing? I know they made a lot of money off prescribing it to a lot of kids in the 80s, believe that. I do think it's also kind of, you know, it's kind of neat that, you know, if I get transferred to another school, the teacher can say, my mom can say, hey, well, he's got ADHD. And the teacher can kind of understand, kind of, okay, well, I know he probably deals with this and that. But nonetheless, trauma is so impactful to the people that we are, to the people that we become. Mm-hmm. And that if we don't start learning how to process that trauma, which is the gist of what the Keep Your Crown On Project is, then we find ourselves in situations like rehabs, like prisons, and dying well before our time. So yes, I think trauma has definitely impacted a lot of it.
Yeah. And so let's talk about the day that Jimmy, the reality, right? Yeah, Jimmy had heard that, hey, I'm not your dad, somebody else is. But the day that it became the reality, is there ever a point during that moment, right, and thereafter, that it may have had anything to do with you as a man, right? With you as your self-esteem and just trying to have that, you know, we know that girls, you know, I don't want to be stereotypical, right? But I want to say this for a second. A lot of times people talk about young girls having daddy issues, when their fathers are not around. But let's talk about what does it look like for young men who also have daddy issues, meaning Jimmy.
Man, let's just say this. It may not be talked about a lot, but we all know people that got them. Men, we all know men that got them. What it looked like for me is not only was I told my whole life, I'm not your real dad anyway, Gary Mullins is, who actually, come to find out, was my real dad. So I already don't feel like enough. You know what I mean? I know that the moment that I step in, because once I hit 12, I've been a big dude. You're not putting your hands on my mother, y'all. I don't care what you're talking about. I'll fight you to the death. So I already don't feel a part of this family. Even though my brother and my mother are phenomenal. I love my mother and my brother. So when I hit 18, it kind of just solidified what I always not only thought, but maybe feared. And I'm a firm believer that, boys, we find our identities in our fathers. Mm-hmm. You know, we know the statistics of what taking away the father from a family does. If you take away the head, the body will fall. And so thank God that me watching my mother get beat, thank God that me watching my mother have things done that should have never been done to any woman didn't turn me into someone that also beats women, because I've never put my hands on a woman in my entire life, even though my addiction made me ruin my marriage. So by the grace of God, I was always learned how to, you know, talk to a woman, treat a woman with respect, you know. Wish I'd have did that a lot more with my ex-wife, because she deserved a lot more than I gave her. Mm-hmm. But yeah, those daddy issues, I'm probably still dealing with some of it today, to be vulnerable, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. I still desire validation. I still desire affirmation. Now, the fact that I love Jesus, the fact that I love Kendrick Lamar, the fact that I think The Office is single-handedly the greatest show that's ever existed, the type of music I listen to, cheeseburgers, you know, all these things that people that know I really like, I'm not going to ever be fake about. That's what I like. I'll stand against a million. I don't care. I stand on what I stand on. But one of the things I had to look at when I got to prison, why do you use your poetry as a tool? Mm-hmm. Because I was so thirsty and so empty, and I needed such validation and affirmation from others, especially men, that I know how dope these bars are. So I know all I got to do is unnaturally gear the conversation within a couple seconds to me spitting a poem. I'm spitting poetry. You didn't even know you asked for it, because you didn't. But I know it's like, oh, man, he's dope. And so when I got to prison, I had realized, like, okay, you built this whole persona of Jimmy the Poet. Yeah, you can impress people, you can inspire, you can bring people to tears with bars, but you don't even know how to take care of your kids. You don't know how to hold down a job. Hmm. You don't know how to balance a budget. And so I think not having a good father, not that my stepfather didn't have a lot of great qualities, he still... Mm-hmm. God rest his soul. I still laugh thinking about some of the things he's done. He was funny. He had a lot of, you know, he used to hold me and tell me he loved me. And I think that was confusing. Mm-hmm. Because I'm like that with my kids. You know, I also yell a lot. I cuss sometimes. I talk about emotional intelligence. I probably need to learn a little bit more of it. But I'm like that.
You're human.
Yeah, for sure.
Give yourself grace.
So it's like, you know, it's like the dichotomy between acknowledging the mistake with the grace of saying, hey, we can always get better. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so, like, my kids have a little brother who I adore. He's not my son, but I love him like he is one. So, you know, I'm always giving him hugs and stuff. I learned that, I believe, from my stepfather. But once I found out I had a real father, that's really who I wanted it from. Mm-hmm. Then I found out I had a little sister. And then, you know, I would have to listen to my real dad blame my mother for never being in my life. And, you know, I remember one time we were living at Orchard Manor. My wife, she was probably already had my second son by now. And I'm all the way at my mom's crib over in Delaware and Grant. And she's calling me like, hey, the boys would really like to see you. And I was like, you know, it's really hot today. I don't know if I'm going to make it up. Let it have been a blunt, though, I would have made it up. And so I learned a long time ago, people do what they want to do. Right. And so those daddy's issues, you know, I think there's still more to be found out. There's still more to be known. I know one thing. I have a father in heaven that mm-hmm. I thank God for. I have another father in Bishop Stockton who's always loved me. I've had other great mentors like Andy Palmer, who God has placed in my life. So where there has been a lot of lack and need and identity crises when it comes to daddy issues, God has supplemented a lot that has really helped me. I hope that answered the question.
It did. That was very deep. What you said, I'm sure, has touched someone and have given someone an insight on maybe what they're dealing with, right? But let me ask you a question that I did not ask.
Okay.
Little boy Jimmy, right? We're gonna get up to your adult life, even though you've given us some of it, right? But little boy Jimmy, who witnessed, who heard mom going through her own elements of domestic violence, what do you wish someone would have said to you as a little boy? And this is why I asked this question, because what I want you to say, not what I want you to say, I'm sorry. What I'm prefacing this to be is that I want your words to be impactful for another child that may be going through what Jimmy went through.
You know, the best way I can answer that is one time in LA County Jail, I was reading a book called Houses of Healing that somebody I believe was in jail wrote for people in jail. And it said, I want you to grab your blanket or whatever you have close to you, and I want you to close your eyes, and I want you to imagine somebody that you trusted. And I imagined Kim Creel and Nita Garland holding my hand, and they were walking me through this door. And this was all just me imagining, meditating. And they were like, the book said, imagine them walking you to the little Jimmy that's hurt, the little Jimmy that's scared. And I want you to start encouraging that Jimmy. And what I would tell a kid right now that's going through that is the same thing I told little Jimmy in that moment in my jail cell, is that it's not your fault. You're more than enough. You're worthy of love just because God loves you. There's never going to be a time that you're going to fully meet all the conditions of everybody's standards of love. So stop trying to do it. But ultimately, none of this is your fault. And you have every right to tell somebody. Going to CPS, you know, going to call the cops, that you're not a snitch. I'm so sick and tired of that no snitching mentality. Yeah, if you're in the game and you snitch on somebody to get yourself out of trouble, that's dirty. But if you're a civilian, snitching's not for civilians. And so I wish I would have called the cops. I wish I would have talked to CPS. I wish that, you know, I would have known that my real dad existed and these grandparents that loved me existed. I would have ran off to Dunbar and been with them. Mm-hmm. You know, but I'll tell you what, I'm so grateful. I'm so extremely grateful for everything I've ever experienced, because now I have the ability right now, having gone through that, to look right in the phone and tell a young person, if you're going through that, or a woman, if you're going through that, that you have to love yourself. You have to know that you deserve better. You know, because after a while, it's like, hey, if you like it, I love it. You feel me? I mean, mm-hmm. I can't live your life for you, but that trauma is, it's like a little three-headed monster. It's not just hope. I hope that answered the question.
It did. So as we're talking about trauma, as you know, many people struggle with trauma. And because you brought up the topic of addiction, I'm going to say many people struggle with trauma as well as addiction.
Absolutely.
And during that time, we know that many feel hopeless, right? So what is one piece of advice that you would give to someone who's in their darkest moment right now?
Right now, if you're actively using, there is no point in doing anything other than immediately going to detox and immediately getting the drugs out of your system first. It's popularly said in 12-step recovery and fellowships that you can't 12-step a drunk guy, because he's going to say whatever he can to you. Mm-hmm. So, you know, step one is let's get the drugs out of our system. Step two would have, and I don't mean step two is in the sense of the 12 steps, but, you know, step two of my lineage of advice would be find a group of people that care about you, because there are people that care about you. My name is Jimmy the Poet Nichols on Facebook. You can reach out to me anytime. I will do everything I can to help you get into a program. I'll take you to a meeting. You can come to church with me, all of that. And there's more people out here that'll do so. But I find that one of my biggest issues is a lot of the same issues that I find in, with clients of mine in the past, is they're actively using, or we're actively using. Yeah, we've never been able to keep a job. We've never been able to maintain a positive relationship. We've never been able to maintain money and all these things. but we think that we're going to somehow magically still be able to do that while holding holding on to the drugs, while holding on to the alcohol. And for most of us, it's just not feasible. One of my really good friends smokes weed every day, and this man accomplishes everything he wants to do. He can do that. More power to him. I don't have that skill set. Mm-hmm. I start smoking weed. I start drinking. I start doing shrooms. Next thing I know, I'm in prison after being on a 6-month meth bender. And a lot of people need to be. There's a phrase in the rooms of recovery called be armed with facts about yourself. And so if you know that you've never been able to maintain a job, if you know that you've never been able to do these things, let's first and foremost get the drugs out of your system. Let's get you around people who have recovered, who have something that you want. And let's start taking those simple instructions, because recovery is difficult, but it is not complex. It really is not.
You know, Jimmy, as we know, addiction is a big topic, right? You have some people who understand it. You have some people who don't. You have some people who don't want to, right? Because I heard you say a word, and your word was choice, right? But what I know about individuals who do not understand addiction is that people get tired, right? The person dealing with the loved one that's using gets tired. The person who is in active addiction, they get tired, right? But let's go to the point to where I've never met a person, and I've worked in an addiction life, right? Like I've worked with addicts for years. I've never met a person who wakes up and say, I just want to mess up my life today. And that's why I'm gonna start using drugs as the first time, right?
Yeah, of course not.
Right. But what I know is this: most people, if not the majority, use drugs because of unhealed trauma. Yeah. Trying to mask, trying to not accept and or deal with past trauma or current trauma, right? And I think that, you know, as we look at our society and our communities are, as we know, you know, I'm going to be very open and very transparent. Our communities are heavily populated with individuals who are sick, with individuals who are homeless. They go hand in hand, right?
Oh,
addiction. Homeless go hand in hand. It's mental health. Whether people want to accept it, I get it, right? I get that it's it can get frustrating. I can get that it can be very intruding on people's life. I get that somebody right now may be watching my podcast and they may not like what I have to say. I too may not like it at times, but I do have compassion. I understand that nobody purposely makes a decision to truly ruin their life. Now, thereafter, when that happens, the decisions thereafter may cause their life to be ruined, but nobody purposely wakes up one day and say, hell with this. I want to mess up my life. It's hell with all my problems. And how can I feel better so I don't have to think about my problems? Right. And so let's talk about, when did Jimmy get like that?
So for some of my answer, I'm going to refer to recovery language. I am in no way, shape, or form a representative of AA or NA or any of those things. And everything I'm going to say is of my own opinion. But, you know, I am a firm believer in 12-step recovery. And, you know, the first step says that we admit that we are powerless over drugs and alcohol and that our lives have become unmanageable. Mm-hmm. Well, the best way I was ever taught is when you break that down. The first part of that step says we admit that we are powerless over drugs and alcohol. It's not so much that I never had the power to stop, because I have stopped plenty of times. It's that without a connection to something greater than me, I can't maintain that power. So imagine that I'm a toaster, right? I could be a toaster from Macy's that's like $65 with a little digital thing on it. Or I could be a toaster from Dollar General that's like $15. If I'm not plugged into a source of power, I'm not toasting nothing. Because I ultimately believe that addiction is a spiritual disease more than anything. I also do believe it is an actual disease. Now, the second part of that, we came to believe that we were powerless over drugs and alcohol. And the second part is that our lives have become unmanageable. It's not so much that I don't know how to balance a budget. It's not so much that I don't know how to manage a household. And a lot of that, I couldn't do that when I was on drugs. But it's emotional unmanageability. We've never been properly taught how to manage our emotions. So what happens the moment things don't go the way we think they should? We get emotionally distraught and we go back to tools that no longer serve us. You feel what I'm saying? And so did my trauma make me a person that suffered from addiction? I don't believe so, but I don't think it helped. I think that the first time I ever got high was maybe peer pressure. Maybe I was just into it. The second time I got high was because I liked the effects produced by it, period. There's no questions in my mind about that. Mm-hmm. Now, every time after, it was either I just wanted to get high or, it eventually became a way for me to heal. So, I don't think nobody wakes up. I definitely didn't decide to want to just wake up and abandon my children in the middle of Los Angeles. I used to scream and cry in the middle of L.A. because I knew that I was not being a father. You know what I mean? And I could not see the forest for the trees. I'll be honest with you. I never thought I would leave Skid Row. It is a blessing that I'm here before you. I never thought that I would be a father again. I never thought that I would be any of that. And so for me, it was going to prison, having that time, once again, like we mentioned earlier, with the drugs and alcohol out of my body. Because, you know, when we get into the pharmacological effects of these things, and I hope I said that word right, you know, meth, for example, it takes sometimes 6-9 months to a year for those lasting effects to leave your body. You feel what I'm saying? And so if a person starts getting high at the time they're 11 and they go to get sober at 30, they're dealing with the emotional intelligence of an 11-year-old.
Right.
Because especially with opiates, especially with drugs that make you dope sick and physically dependent, everything becomes of that. Because addiction is a disease of selfishness and self-centeredness. And a lot of people think that self-centeredness just means I think I'm the ish all the time. No, it's when you are quite literally the center of your thoughts. Mm-hmm. And so this, once again, goes back to the spiritual side of addiction, is let's get the drugs out of your system. Let's get around some people that are spiritually mature. Let's learn how to start serving other people. Because in order to, if we're going to fix the addiction, which is selfishness, maybe an antithesis to that is selflessness, if that makes sense. Okay. But to get back to the answer to the question, no, I don't think people just wake up and want to ruin their lives. But unfortunately, we all go through tough things. Maybe your dad beat your mother. Maybe, you know, you went through other worse things, but you're ultimately responsible for your decisions. And after a while, people don't want to hear it no more. You know what I mean? And it sucks because that was my life too, you know? So.
Right. So Jimmy the Poet, you don't have that name just because that's what you was named, right? Your mother didn't name you the Poet. So what I know is that poetry is you, right? It's often a reflection maybe of what you've been through, what you're going through, or just a matter of just being able to express yourself. So tell me, what does poetry really mean to you when it comes to healing?
Oh, man. Well, I wanted to be a rapper at first, but Tupac's Rose That Grew From Concrete. Tupac said, "Have you ever heard of the rose that grew from concrete, proving nature's law wrong? It learned to walk without having feet. Funny it seems, but by keeping its dreams, it learned to breathe fresh air. Long live the rose that grew from concrete when no one else ever cared." The moment I heard that, I viewed myself as that rose growing from concrete because of people like Kim and Nita Garland and Emmanuel and other people that would speak of my purpose and my potential despite the concrete that I was growing up through. And so, I mean, even before the poetry, like the Marshall Mathers LP, Eminem's album, I used to sit there and I would memorize that album. And I think it kind of helped me to where, like, I don't get on stage with pieces of paper. I have all my stuff memorized. Mm-hmm. And I would memorize that album. I memorized the DMX album. I memorized the Tupac album. And by the time I would have to memorize every syllable, say it the way they said it perfectly 3 times in a row before I can move on to the next song. And I would do that in the midst of my mom and my dad arguing. I'd go in the bathroom and I would memorize rap songs. And I would escape into the music. I would escape into the music, man. And then the poetry, you know, Tupac, Maya Angelou, Langston Hughes, I fell in love with these poets, you know, that Still I Rise for Maya Angelou. Sometimes people think I'm mixed or Hispanic, but most people know that I'm white. And so in 11th grade multicultural fest, I guess the teacher thought I was mixed. So they had me do a poem from Langston Hughes from the perspective of somebody that was mixed. And I didn't even realize that was the poem was about when I did it. I just knew I loved Langston Hughes. But, yo, it's always been, like, I haven't really put pen to paper in coming up on 20 years. I just freestyle and I take bits and pieces and turn it into poetry. Mm-hmm. But man, if I, I think they call it freestyle for a reason, because there's freedom there. If I didn't have that, oh, plenty of night, whether it was Skid Row, plenty of night, whether it was, you know, on Madison Street, down the street from Tiscawal, outside crying because I don't know what's going on. If I didn't have, that's why creative expression is so important for Keep Your Crown On, because it's such a phenomenal outlet for people. And there are people that are going through things that I've gone through, and they have to hear about it. You know, they have to hear that, hey, I know, not only do I know what that's like, but I made it through that. And when I can put it in dope poetical form, that's just like the cherry on the cake, to be honest with you.
So, you know, as we talk about this, right, I know you open up this episode with doing a poem, right? Absolutely. Go ahead and spit us a little bit of poetry right now, whether it's something that you created when you were in active addiction that helped you get through that moment, or something that you've been able to do since being in recovery.
Okay. My plan completely was to spit three pieces, so I will allow this to be the second, and then I would love to end it off with one of the most important pieces I've ever written. So this really exemplifies what it was like when I was on the streets of LA before I went to prison. I said, it's crazy how we glorify whips and chains, but we don't realize that we whipped and chained. And I still need answers, like why the FBI destroyed the Black Panthers and the Army teaching us to be all that we can be, but they still harming us with that Willie Lynch speech. And I'm like, yeah, you best believe it, but I'm still going to fight for the same thing Jesus would fight for. So I might explore why we so deaf to our community, our own people. We so evil, but we deserve immunity for what writing raps about traps that keep us trapped. Yo, they doing heroin, kid. That dog food, I have all of you sharing your kicks. Whether the reference is your shoes or the amount of neglect that you're feeling from the abuse, not an ounce of respect can be given within the hidden clues. Or what about the gems hidden instilled in you? Ooh, it's like we worth a room full of jewels, but we still bouncing them checks. And after some time inside, we become Jekyll and Hyde. Pure conceptions of the truth versus deception and lies. So if it's obvious that incompetence can cause a crack within my confidence, then can I conclude that the inability to inhibit calamity is a direct derivative of dealing with decisions limited by insanity? Because it no longer makes sense to me how we could orchestrate all these evil acts, yet feel entitled to entire orchestras and symphonies full of sympathy, when it's simple to see that it's decisions and deeds that lead to the need for the deliverance of our misery. So if ever I'm feeling blue, it's not at all from what others have done. It's me doing what I always do. So if it's true that there's nothing new under the sun, no wonder why I rarely have won. I'm showing up to the gunfight with a knife when I could have, should have showed up to the knife fight with a gun. But the battlefield is in the mind. We've been told before we were pre-warned about this war. Now they want souls and more. So I guess that means that there's a need to get back to the soul start of me. It's just not a path that I can attack haphazard but wholeheartedly. So if we're going to build, let's build. Just give me an intergalactic arts and crafts package and a whole map to where our garden be. Because I'm planting seeds for the harvesting of the final one hardening of my heart so I can finally realize if real plays any real part in me. Because part of me. But I'm sick of these falsely focused filters. It's like closely scoping out your circle because the closest man to kill you. But if real recognize real, then the man in the mirror looking real unfamiliar. So your inability to be feeling me is irrelevant now. To my frenemies, ain't no killing me, I'm heavenly bound. I spit Christ crucified and resurrected, showing reverence how I'm spitting the same in front of gospel and secular crowds. I was out cold fiend and suppressing the sounds of them stone cold demons caressing me how? I don't know, just tell Lucy Papa's home, place a proper the crown. I'm a king by birthright, there ain't no knocking me down. How it feel, Lucille? I got that ball in my hand. In my court, that divorce ain't put a stall in our plan. We still a team raising kings, so acknowledge the plan. If you ain't heard Lucifer, we own all of this land. Strategies of warfare.
Wow. Wow. That was very powerful. A lot of messages, right? Like it's one of those moments that, you know, I always taught my kids, and I was taught as well. Are you hearing things or are you listening? Right. So if you were just hearing it, you may have missed a lot of messages that you gave there. But if you was truly listening, you said a lot of powerful. From being an ally, right, to being able to overcome obstacles, to be able to recognize who you are and who you want to be. I mean, it was just
That's all I can say, right? I'm going to go ahead and snap my fingers. I think that's what they say you do, right? You just snap your fingers.
Yeah, I don't know how to snap, so it don't work for me, but I appreciate it.
Yeah, so if you watching right now, our live, if you want to just go ahead and put some snapping, I see Angelica did that. If you want to just go ahead and put some snapping in the chat right now for Jimmy to pull it, because again, I hope that you wasn't just hearing what he said. I hope that you was actually listening to what he said. So that takes me to something, Jimmy.
Okay.
Keep your crown on, right? You've alluded to keeping your crown on a lot in this here episode. And even when I talked with you, you spoke a lot about keep your crown on. Keep your crown on, first of all, let me tell you, this is a very powerful message. But what I know is that it's also your business. So let me also say this once again, keep your crown on LLC. I heard you talk about that when you were in prison, that's when this came to you. That's when the vision came to you. But what exactly does it mean to you? And how do you hope to inspire others by telling them to keep your crown on?
There's not really one answer. I would have to say for me, first and foremost, is being a dedicated follower to the Lord, Yeshua the Messiah, Jesus the Christ. That's very important to me. I don't believe that I personally can keep my crown on if I'm not. I think what it boils down to is living a life of principle. And there's lots of principles we can live by. Mm-hmm. When I got out of prison, I got a job at a gas station. I did not want to work at a funky little gas station. You feel me? Mm-hmm. For $12 an hour. I told myself three things. I'm going to show up on time. I'm going to add value. And I'm going to live honestly. To me, that's what keep your crown on means. What keep your crown on means to me is coming back 4 years ago, just so that I never wanted to leave LA. I love Los Angeles. The only time I ever wanted to go back to West Virginia was once I was established to make a difference here, because the plan has always been to help Charleston, West Virginia, more than I want to help any other place in this map. I love where I'm from. I want to help the youth in the city. I love Darrell Miller, Taran Rush, all these people that are pouring into the city. I love them and I love my city. That, to me, is keeping your crown on. Darrell Miller keeps his crown on. Taran Rush keeps his crown on. Woody Woods keeps his crown on. You keep your crown on. Leisha Lee definitely keeps her crown on. The list can go forth and forth. George Mitchell keeps his crown on. You feel what I'm saying? And Helica, she's raising a phenomenal daughter. She's keeping her crown on. So keep your crown on can mean a lot of different things. But if you ever go see my symbol, which my daughter, bless her soul, she drew this one for me, and I told her this would be the official symbol of keeping the crown on. Do you notice that the crown is tilted?
Yes.
And it will always be, because it's always a process to keep it on. Nobody ever has the crown on straight forever, because we're human beings living a human experience. Mm-hmm. So, you know, being a father, being a mother, helping the community members, this today, and I usually don't brag about the things I do for other people. I just let them be. I let God see them, and that's all that really matters. But, you know, right. I pulled up the sheets, and this older lady, probably in her 60s or 70s, was trying to figure out the air pump for her tires. And I was like, hey, go ahead and sit down, baby. I got you. You need some air in your tires? Yeah, I got you. That's keeping your crown on. You know, mm-hmm. The lady that can't bend her elbows on Second Avenue, and I'm just making stuff up. I'm not thinking of someone specific. So don't be mm-hmm. over here looking at Second Avenue for non-bendable elbows. But, you know, the lady that can't bend her elbows and she needs her grass cut, you know, going to cut her grass and not charging her, that's keeping your crown on. So it really means living a life of principle, being of service to other people, and, you know, being the father, being the mother, being the community member that you were called to be.
So, Jimmy the father, Jimmy the poet, Jimmy the motivational speaker, Jimmy the business owner. How do you balance all this while staying true to your purpose?
It's tough. One thing anybody's ever going to get from me is complete authenticity. The business owner aspect is relatively new. I've not made money off Keep Your Crown On. I'll be honest with you, I don't know if I ever will. Don't really care, as long as I can continue teaching people how to do it. I mean, don't get me wrong. I envision myself with $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 speaker fees. I believe that I have the gift to make that happen. I just also know that for church, for AA, for a recovery house, I'm never going to charge you. I'm never going to charge you to give you gain. You feel what I'm saying? So the business part, I'm figuring out. The father thing, that historically has been the most important thing in my entire life. But you see, I'm learning that I can only go love God because he first loved me, which means I can only really love others when I learn to love God. So the thing I'm having to learn now after being, I'm not a single father by any stretch of the imagination. Me and their mother co-parent, and let me give her her flowers. She's phenomenal. I would not, there would be no Keep Your Crown On if there was no Sarah. There would be no me on this podcast right now if it wasn't for Sarah. Her holding down my kids for 7 years by herself. And let's be honest, she did it longer than that because I wasn't a deadbeat dad per se, but I wasn't an active father like I needed to be even before I left for California. So all of this Jimmy off in the wilderness getting himself together would have never happened without Sarah because she held my kids down. You know, so I have to give her flowers for that. So coming back and being a father means everything to me, you know, but what I'm learning now is I have to really kind of get back to the mindset I was when I was in prison, waking up, spending time with the Lord, getting my mind right in the mornings, because if I'm really going to be a good father, I have to first be a good son to the Father. You know what I mean? And that's becoming more, a little bit more important to me right now. When I first got back, I wanted to do Keep Your Crown On in the schools, this, that, but for the first 3 years, I was like, you know what? Let's get your house in order first. Like, yeah, I can help any kid in the world, but I'm no good to nobody if I can't help my own four kids. You know, we got coaches out here coaching in Little League now, and I don't know anybody specific, so I'm not going to name somebody specific. This isn't the gossip hour, but it's like, yo, take care of your own kids. You feel me? Like, take care of your kids. It's so important. I have a line in one of my poems. It's like, if you smoke crack, then you obviously lame. If you ain't fathering your children, I consider you the same. All these young men harboring the pain for carrying on a name for a daddy who's never been there. What a shame I gotta carry you on. And you ain't never even carried me in your arms. And so coming back to West Virginia to be a father was my number one goal. So yeah, you know, trying to balance all of it. It's tough. I wouldn't be able to do it without their mother, period. No questions asked. So, yeah.
How has the reintegration been back with the children? I mean, obviously, you know, kids love their fathers, right? Kids love their parents. But when it comes to trust, have you seen that your kid still has some hesitation, not knowing what dad's going to be every day?
Once again, I got to give flowers to their mother, man. She's never tried to keep my kids from me. She had every right to, because I see really, really good men go through things they should not go through that are really, really good fathers. And it sometimes breaks my heart because I'm like, man, the very thing they're getting, they don't deserve. I actually did deserve, but God's grace and mercy was so good that I guess he just softened her heart to make sure that I didn't have to go through that. Because coming back, kids are very resilient. And my kids were just happy to have daddy back. Other than my 10-year-old who, up until 3 years ago, we had met a couple times. I didn't know him that well. All my other three kids, you know, I cut two of their umbilical cords. I helped name half of them, you know, whether I gave one name, the last middle name, whatever. So my kids knew who I was, but they were just happy to have daddy back. You know, there's been times they had to tell me like, yo, man, we're not tripping on you. You're here now. Why are you tripping on the past? I be tripping on the past more than they do. And I have to say that that's really just I'm not saying that people that haven't had it that easy are not also experiencing the grace of God in other areas of their life. I just know that in that specific area of my life, God has shined his grace on me. Because if I got what I deserved, I would never see these kids again in my life. If I got the same energy I exhibited out for 7 years, they wouldn't know me, because that's honestly what I deserve, you know. But for the grace of God and for the grace of their mother and for her recognizing how important a father is, you know what I mean? She told me recently, she said, listen, since you've gotten back, they've become so stabilized in so many areas. And that means the world to me. That my 16-year-old son knows how to be a gentleman to his girlfriend. That my 14-year-old daughter has a 4.4. You know, that my second oldest son, the dude's going to be way smarter and funnier than I will ever be. And I would like to take some credit for it. I mean, I guess I got good genes, but, you know, their mother, she did a lot of that. You know what I mean? So she kept them in church. I know I keep bringing her up, but I have to give her flowers, man, because... Yeah, she deserves it.
you said something that I was listening to again, right? Who your kids were before daddy came home, and who your kids are now that mommy and daddy are here. Although you all are co-parenting, you're still present, right? 100%. I think that says a lot in the development of a child. That says a lot in the development of a child growing into a young man or a young woman, right? It's just being able to have parents that can be present to deposit unconditional love, to be able to deposit structure. And everybody's structure looks different, right? To know that when they go to school, they can at least say, I can talk to my mother and I can talk to my father. And one may say, Keisha, why do you say that? Because not every parent is going to be together in the same home, right? And I say this, and I'm going to talk about myself for a second. Absolutely. I remember there was a point of my life where I said, my kids don't need a husband and wife, right? I wanted to be a wife who wanted a husband. My husband wanted to be a husband who wanted a wife. But my kids didn't need a husband and wife. What my kids needed was a mother and father, right? The husband and wife was something that we vowed to do. A mother and a father is something that we were given the opportunity to do. And so you saying how your children's mother were able to talk about how the kids are different now that mom and dad are present in their life is powerful. It's very powerful. And it speaks volume.
I mean, we know, I love how you said this is raw and rugged, and we can say what we want, because this may hurt some feelings, and it's all good. You know, life is meant to have your feelings hurt. If you're walking through life and your feelings are never hurt, then you live in a bubble, homie. And once that bubble get bust, you really fitting to be in trouble. But
let me interject for 1 second, Jimmy. This is what I say about this podcast here, right? Anybody who know me, I probably said every podcast, I don't believe in talking about things that's comfortable, because comfortable doesn't allow for change. I believe in talking about things that's uncomfortable, because uncomfortable makes you think. It may hurt your feelings for a second, but everything ain't gonna always be roses and peaches and all nice, right? So on this podcast here, it's all about discussing things that are uncomfortable that most people shy away from. So let's go back to being raw. There you go.
That part. I'm a firm believer that the way God designed the family was a man, a woman, and children. And the nuclear family is vital. And that's not to take away from other family types that have also raised great kids, because they do. We can't deny that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we know the statistics of fatherlessness, especially in the Black community, especially in the hood, you know. And I say that because all four of my kids are mixed. So get out your mm-hmm. feelings if you're tripping, because I said that, you'll be all right. Not you, but, you know, anybody listening.
Sure, I got it.
But, you know, the last statistic I heard that was in 1968, 75% of African-American households had the father in the home. We jump up to 1988, less than 25% had the father in the home. And now we're in 2025. The last statistic I heard, I think it was 2018 or something. It was like a 10%. I don't know. But long story short, the numbers may even be a little off. But we know that if you take away the head, the body's going to fall. So we truly do have an epidemic of fatherlessness. Is it the only thing? Of course not. You know what I mean? And can a woman teach a boy everything he needs to be a man? You know, the jury's out on that. I think the most opportune situation is to have a strong, you know, spiritually wise, spiritually smart man that has, you know, there's an attack on masculinity. There definitely is some versions of toxic masculinity that are out there, but let's not sit here and say that masculinity in and of itself is toxic. That's ridiculous. We need young boys to learn how to be young men, and it takes men to teach that. But I think God blesses in the interim. You know, there are lots of phenomenal single mothers that have done great, phenomenal jobs. We all are either products of it or know people that are products of it. So, you know, I think there's a difference on what the most opportune of situations can be versus what God steps in and blesses in the process. It might be bringing a stepdad in. It might be the auntie and the uncles in the community. It might be that football coach that really makes a difference in a kid's life. Shout out to James Washington, man. That dude is phenomenal. And so, yeah, man, I think, you know, having a father is and having a mother and a father. And if you guys are listening and you are not with the mother of your children or the father of your children, you'll never hear me call my kid's mom baby mama. She is not my baby mama. She is the mother of my children. And you're having issues, it would behoove you, it would behoove the mental health of your children to start finding common ground. It would really behoove everybody so that we can get back to it takes a village to raise a child, so we can get back to strong community, membership, leadership, and we can get to a place that's different. Because all this bickering and beefing you're doing, the child is really the one that's getting hurt in the process. Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
No, it makes perfect sense, more than what you know. Because it becomes a learned behavior, right? Absolutely. Either you learn to do it, either you learn not to do it. But statistically, most are learning to do what they see.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that disagreements, if you walk around agreeing with everybody, you're not really living life. You know, and I think one of the biggest tools that I have in my tool belt is knowing how to chew up the meat and spit out the bones. Mm-hmm. I don't have to agree with everything you say, but there might be a nugget of wisdom in there that I can use and make applicable to my life.
So, Jimmy, as we are getting closer to the end of Heart to Heart with Keisha B, this bonus episode, what I want to ask you is, looking ahead, what legacy do you hope to leave behind through your work? And what's next for Keep Your Crown On?
I think that where there are no vision, people perish. You know, and where there's no vision, people cast off restraint. So I think having a vision for the future is vital. And I would love to see that Keep Your Crown On can teach a generation of young people. It started developing when I got out of prison. I started teaching groups and rehabs. And I was like, man, why are we not preemptively giving these same tools to adolescents? Why are we waiting for them, like myself, an adult, to go mess my life up when, you know, we live in a culture that's already based off curing disease when we could do a lot more work if we were more preventative. So it's kind of even, you know, the mental health issues are kind of indicative to the physical health issues that we face in this country. So my vision for Keep Your Crown On is to see a generation of young people healed, whole, learning how to process trauma, having emotional intelligence. I have this crazy vision of the Clay Center being booked out for a Keep Your Crown On production of young middle and high schoolers putting on either their own self-directed, self-produced, self-scripted play that they act in, or a poetry show. There's just so much that I have envisioned for it. I want to take the Keep Your Crown On project into the prison system and teach men and women that you do not have to worry about not being a father from behind bars. Let me teach you how to communicate with your kids when you're behind bars. Here's a gift package of, you know, a phone card and stationery and stamps, because we can't expect recidivism to be reduced if people lose familial contact. I imagine Keep Your Crown On having to go bags together for men and women when they first get out of prison. Hey, here's $100 gift card to Gabe's. Here's some socks. You don't worry about buying new uniforms. We got programs that'll do that, because I just think they Keep Your Crown On's approach and the vision is a holistic approach to heal the family. It's not just on the kids. I think mm-hmm. I'm frozen. It's not just on the mother. It's not just on the father. It takes a village to raise a child. And I think that if I'm going to sit here and claim that God's perfect design is to have families together, then we need to learn how to heal the whole family structure, the whole family unit. So, yeah, I would love to see this city transformed in a lot of ways. And I think that it starts, like, you look at a Taran Rush, right? Mm-hmm. Taran would not be where he's at right now. And I'm sure he would vouch for this, if he didn't have people like a Ken Creel, Anita Garland, and the other people that he would give credit to in his personal life to mm-hmm. pour into him at such a young age to realize how important after school programs are. And that's why they have the Midian Project. You feel what I mean? Mm-hmm. Darrell Miller, he would not be doing the things he's doing if somebody did not pour into him when he was a youth. You feel what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I would not have this vision if I did not have people of the Lord and other strong community members pouring into me when I was a youth. So mm-hmm. it takes a village to raise a child. You know, we have to continue to pour into this youth. I just think that I have a unique niche when it comes to the emotional intelligence, the processing trauma through creative expression, which is the mission statement for Keep Your Crown On. That's it.
All right. So, again, as we leave, one of the questions, my last question I always ask, two last questions I always ask my guest, if there is a heart-to-heart message that you could leave to our audience today, whether it's those that are listening live or those who will listen later, what would that heart-to-heart message be to them?
I remember when I was 18, a friend of mine had saw that my glow for the Lord had left, and he saw that I was making some choices that weren't great. And he said, hey, I don't know what's going on with you, but if you ever bent God down for anybody or anybody, he'll always bring you back to the place you left him. 12 years later, I'm walking around a prison yard and I'm crying and I'm like, God, why my kids won't write me? And it wasn't that they didn't want to, and it wasn't that their mom didn't want to. But when you're raising four kids by yourself, it's kind of hard to get them to write. You know, you got life going on. And I heard God's voice clear as day, not in my ears, but in my heart. He said, it's my time now. And that moment of desperation of me wanting to just have a relationship with my kids, and with me knowing that there's nothing they could ever do to stop me from loving them, I finally realized what makes me think God is any different. We're so worried about being cleaned up to come to him. We're so worried about the actions that we've partaken in, where all the Father's ever been asking is, hey, I just want you to have a relationship with me. So if I can encourage anybody on the other end of this is, listen, stop trying to get yourself perfect. You cannot make yourself perfect. All God has ever asked is to have a relationship with you. And just like a lot of you have children and there's nothing that they could ever do to stop you from loving them, there's nothing you're ever going to do to stop God from loving you. So just, you know, reach out and make that relationship happen.
You just hit another point again, because Miss Keisha's listening, of a misconception. A misconception that is often heard, often felt, and often believed. Because a parent is addicted to drugs, many people think, as well as children, that the parent does not love their child. Being that I am a product of addicts, I know that is far-fetched from the truth. What I know is that, and I'll speak for myself, what I know, if my mother and my father can come back today and talk to me, what they would say was this: Keisha, I loved you, but unfortunately, because of my addiction, it didn't allow for me to give you the love in which you deserved. Okay. It didn't allow for me to give you the attention that you deserved. And so I say that because I heard you say love, and I also heard you say your children. And I want this message to be heard very clearly by our audience, whether you are battling addiction, whether you know someone who's battling addiction, whether you've been judgmental. Okay, let me be real. Whether you've been judgmental about someone who may have left their child, they didn't leave their child because they didn't love their child. Unfortunately, the addiction had a hold of their rational being. The addiction had a hold of their rational thought. Some may agree, some may not. But being that I am a child of two parents who were heavily addicted to drugs, and that is why they're not with me today, I know my parents love me. And I know that the addiction happened to love them a little bit more than what they were able to give to me at that point of my life. Not because they didn't want to, but because they could not. And so I know y'all gotten many of messages and inspirations and been educated a lot today on this episode. But if there's another piece that you can add as you take with you today, please know that a parent does not, by choice, put a drug before their child. The addiction causes them to make a lot of irrational decisions. And that is why many times what you see may not be what you agree. But understand that parents do love their children. The addiction is the issue. The addict is the person. There's nothing else you get from heart to heart from Keisha B. Learn to love people and be less judgmental about people's issues, because we all got them.
You know, I love that you said that. One of the things that I've asked clients, right? And I'm an Uber driver. I'm also a hood Uber driver, so holler at me. You know, I'll get women. I've gotten men that are in the back of the car and they're crying. And they're like, I'm sorry. I said, hey, this is a safe place. It's okay. This is a safe place. You can cry here. It's not a problem. You know, and when I sense that, you know, love is the issue, I'll ask somebody, I'll say, are you worthy of love? Some say no. The answer I love is when people say yes. And then I hit them with this, why? And they say, oh, well, because the way I love, I'm nice. I'm kind to people. I forgive people. I'm loyal. And I say, okay, that's cool. What about the times you're not? Mm-hmm. Because we all live in duality. Nobody is one thing all the time.
Correct.
I say, so what about the times you're not the good person? And they just look befuddled and bamboozled. And I'm like, listen, if your definition of why you're worthy of love is anything other than one, God loves you, two, you're worthy of love just because you're worthy of love, then now we are dealing with conditional love, and no one person's always going to be able to meet the conditions. And I think that's major in how we view ourselves, how we interact with others. The number one rule in counseling, it may be the number one rule in healthcare in general, is do no harm. And so, you know, I have had to learn how to wear different hats. You know, I've had to put the professional hat on. I've had to put the case manager hat on. So I'm a firm believer that everybody has moments. You know, Jimmy talks about emotional intelligence. The last thing I want you to see is me getting out at the car, probably cussed my son out. And it's like, that's your only experience with me. You probably think I'm a terrible father. You know, long story short, I think that if we would all give each other more grace to say, hey, they're probably just having a moment. You know, I think we would be in a lot better place peace-wise.
Yeah. You know, I tell my younger son, sometimes he's hard on himself, right? Like he criticizes himself when other folks is not. So what I say to him every morning before he gets out the car is this, it's just a moment. I also say I love him, but I also say it's just a moment. I say that because I know that as he exits my car, he is doomed to face some type of challenge throughout the day. And I can't be there to always fix his challenges. I can't be there to always straighten up his crown, right? But what I'm teaching him in life is that it's just a moment. Make it through that moment to prepare yourself for the next moment. Because the next moment, we don't know what's going to happen. But what we know is what's happening in this moment. And that's all that we can worry about is this moment to help us prepare for that next moment, right?
That and I can start over at any given time. I don't have to wait till tomorrow to start over. If it's 3 p.m. in the afternoon, I haven't met none of the goals for today, I feel like crap, it's like, oh, wait a minute. I can start over at any given time. I can go make my bed right now. You feel me? And I'm preaching to the choir because my bed ain't made right now either. You know what I mean? But yeah, man, like you can start your day over at any given time. You know, and I think one of the greatest things I've learned too is that there are points of arrival in my life. You know, there will be places of accomplishment. There will be, you know, what they say, new levels, new devils. But there is not one singular point of arrival that I'm ever going to get to in this natural life on earth that where I've arrived. There's no more growing. There's no more elevating. Right. It's like, yeah, you feel me? I don't think that works like that. You know what I mean? So
Jimmy the poet. We're not going to end this podcast without you closing it out with a poem.
All right.
This is your moment.
This is called Message from the Maker. This is as if God is speaking to us. I understand your pain and fear. My son shed blood like you shed tears. So please believe I truly see how difficult it is to be like me. But I inspire you to see that it's a lot less stressful, plus worth it, to aspire to be me instead of everyone else you admire and envy. They're not perfect and they're all going to expire within the time I've given. So if it's in you I'm living, it's because I chose to. I know the thorns seem thickened, but it's within you I rose through. You see, I don't create junk, because if I did, you think I sent my only son for them to pierce his rib, for me to shed my blood? The most delicate element never developed, embellished that with you I can share this love? Nah. So let me pose to you a question. If after creating Pinocchio, which you know to be a blessing, he jumps off the table, come to life, start disrespecting himself. He hates the mirror, so he spends his whole life correcting himself. And you know that as his father sending a couple blessings would help, but like the rest of himself, he gets rejected as well. So what would you do as his maker? The creator just disrespected creation. How would you feel as his creator? Send him a savior, right? To save his life. Take away his sin, put him in a robe as white as snow. He says it's appreciated, but that boy Pinocchio, his nose still grows. So why do we lie to ourselves? We claim we want Jesus, but won't die to ourselves. It seems to me like we only lie for the wealth and prosperity, but what's scaring me is the way they deliver that whole package is lying itself. We ain't blessed and prosperous for our own desires, and so his kingdom could be advanced, so we can snatch sinners out the fire. So if it's within our acceptance that his death and resurrection was to win our affection, then why every time he blesses, we disrespect him? And if we think that's crazy, that ain't it. The craziest is all he's ever asked from us is a relationship. But men and women, we as well have fell victim to a plot and plan of lies that have been devised to have us kill ourselves. To kill ourselves. Because we're pursued by an enemy who's misconstrued our identity. And he's had us for thousands of years as practice. You see, we bear the Father's image. So all Satan had to do, pervert our perception of our Father in heaven. And since the beginning, that's basically his number one tactic, strategies of warfare.
And again, I snapped my finger. I don't know if anybody else.
I'm halfway through that poem.
You're fine. You're fine. The message was well received. Again, I've snapped my fingers, right? I don't know if anybody else in the audience is going to snap their fingers, but as we get ready to close out Heart to Heart with Keisha B on this week's episode, Jimmy, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for being transparent. I want to thank you for Keep My Crown On, a story of redemption, faith, and purpose, right? You shared yourself with us. You gave us pieces that people may or may have not known. Right. And you was very vulnerable in order to do that. So what I want to challenge our guest today is to continue to follow Jimmy the Poet Nichols on his social media platforms. Continue to watch different advertisements here in the community, because I know that he does go to different places and he does live poetry as well. So I'm all about making sure that we support each other. And as we talk about support, I ask that you please continue to support Heart to Heart with Keisha B. You can find me here on Sundays for our bonus episode, which is always going to be live. You can always find me on Wednesdays. Our episodes drop on Wednesdays as well at 8 o'clock a.m. You can find me on Spotify, Apple, and as always, thank you for following Heart to Heart with Keisha B. Thank you for tuning in to Heart with Keisha B. Remember, grief may shape our journey, but it doesn't define who we are. Healing is not a straight path, but with every step forward, you're creating space for hope, strength, and new beginnings. If today's episode brought you comfort or clarity, share it with someone who might need it too. Let's continue building this community of compassion and resilience together. Until next time, take care of your heart, your mind, and your soul. Honor your journey and always know that brighter days are ahead. I am Keisha B, and this has been Heart to Heart.